Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo. And tonight we're going to do a little something different. We're going to play our last night's program, the beginning of our last night's program, and in our interview with John Brennan.
Who's a guest on our show.
Who's a regular a freelance reporter who keeps us abreast of the different things that are happening out there and different movements and environmental and chemtrails and so on. But we're going to go with him tonight. But we have a lot of interesting information on the H1N1 virus that we wanted to present to you that we did on our last night's show. And there is a letter, Lila starts off a letter by Congressman Ron Paul, open letter to Barack Obama, saying, why have you not vaccinated your own children?
Mm.
All right, and
it's not an open letter, it's a report on the letter that he read.
Well, it's an open letter. Basically, it was a letter to him. You know? And so that's that. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Good show, and we hope you get the flavor of last night's show. It's kind of interesting to...
Yep, I think you'll enjoy our friend John Brennan's segment as our reporter. And
hopefully they'll take
the hope you get some information and that you pursue some of the topics on your own
so that
you can get even more information.
Yeah, absolutely. So we wish you the very best. We'll be back right after the show close with closing comments. And I hope you enjoy.
Ron Paul questions why Obama daughters haven't taken the swine flu vaccine. Congressman Ron Paul has questioned why, despite his efforts to encourage the general public to get vaccinated against the H1N1 virus, President Barack Obama has refused to allow his own doctors to take the swine flu jab. Despite the fact that Obama on Friday declared a national emergency in response to the H1N1 outbreak, he apparently doesn't deem it enough of a threat to have his two daughters vaccinated against the virus. Such double standards have led media pundits to call for Obama to get his daughters vaccinated on live television in an effort to encourage American parents to do the same for their kids. The swine flu vaccination program, which was initially intended to be a mass inoculation covering the entire population, has been rejected by the majority of Americans who harbor deep suspicions about dangerous additives contained in the vaccine, such as mercury and squalene. In a Campaign for Liberty video message, former presidential candidate Ron Paul labeled the vaccination program a failure and slammed Obama for failing to follow the same advice he gave to the nation. Isn't it interesting to note that the president's children have not gotten their shots, and the explanation for this is it hasn't been available to them? Now, that's a little bit hard to buy when you think that probably anything the president wants can be available for their children, said Paul, adding, so in a way, he's made a decision not to give his children these inoculations. So if he has freedom of choice on this, I would like to make sure that all the American people have the same amount of freedom choice. Others have echoed similar sentiments. Surely, if there's a national emergency, and if the President and First Lady of the United States wanted flu shots for their daughters, they could get them. It is certainly connected to our national security, right? I mean, the President needs to have his wits about him 24/7, not worrying over sick children. Could this instead be yet another case of do as I say, not as I do, from the Obama administration? Paul compared Obama's hypocrisy to politicians who lobby for the virtues of public education, yet in every instance educate their own children privately. The biggest champions of public education make sure their kids never get public education. They always get private education where there's a lot better choices than the kind of system they're promoting, said the congressman. Obama certainly isn't stupid enough to inject his own kids with the same toxic soup that he encourages the idiot public to receive, and will probably be keen on getting access to the special additive-free swine flu shots produced by Baxter International that have been made available for the elite. As Spiegel Online reported earlier this month, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and government ministers received a mercury and squalene-free H1N1 vaccine. The vaccine does not contain disputed additives, contrary to the vaccine for the remainder of the population, reported the magazine. Soldiers in Germany were also given the adjunct-free vaccine. Employees of the Paul Ehrlich Institute in Germany also received the green inoculation after their president, Johann Lauer, labeled the vaccine a greatest test on the virus itself. Lauer's comments came after the German lung specialist Wolfgang Wartarg said the vaccine increases the risk of cancer. The nutrient solution for the vaccine consists of cancerous cells from animals. In the video update, Congressman Paul also warned that Obama's emergency declaration on Friday was part of a plan to condition people to accept the notion of a government as a protector and coerce the public into complying whatever they say, including forced quarantines. So that was Mr. Obama.
Yeah.
Ron Paul on his choices.
Yeah, the Cold and Flu Center. Women... Pregnant women wary of fine swine flu shot. Survey shows most women, most pregnant women and moms of young kids won't get vaccinated. This is as of yesterday. A new survey shows only about 1 in 4 pregnant women and mothers of young children plan to get the H1N1 flu vaccine this year, despite recommendations from public health groups urging them to do so. The CDC, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and many other public health organizations strongly recommend that pregnant women and new mothers get both the seasonal and H1N1 flu vaccine shot to protect themselves as well as their newborns. The survey shows 43% of women and mothers of children younger than 2 years old plan to get a seasonal flu shot this year, up from 33% surveyed last year, but only 27% plan on getting the H1N1 flu vaccine. Oh, women are wising up. They don't have this stuff in there, you know. And researchers say confusion and concerns about the safety and effectiveness of the H1N1 vaccine may be preventing many pregnant women from getting the additional protection that they need. All right. And I'm not going to waste any more time on this one, but if you want to go to check out the article, it's a good article. You go to WEBMD, WEBMD.com/cold-and-flu/news. And if you keep slashing for the rest of your life here, it'll come up pregnant women wary of swine flu shot. All right. So check that one out, please. And you got another one, or I'm angry. I should probably do this one just quick.
Go ahead. You have another one on the swine flu?
Yeah, a quick one here. Just wanted to read this one. Boston launches a flu shot tracking. Using a technology originally developed for mass disasters, Boston disease trackers are embarking on a novel experiment, one of the first in the country, aimed at eventually creating a citywide registry of everyone who has had a flu vaccination. This is by Boston Globe or Boston.com. The trial starts this afternoon when several hundred people are expected to queue up for immunizations at the headquarters of the Boston Public Health Commission. Each of them will get a braceleted bracelet printed with a unique identifier code, right? And information about the vaccine's recipients and the shot will be entered into handheld devices similar to those used by delivery truck drivers. So if you're going to get a flu shot, 300 are going to get a flu shot, and they're going to get tracking devices, and like animals, you know. Infectious disease specialists in Boston and elsewhere predicted that the registry approach could prove even more useful if something more sinister strikes, like a bioterrorism attack on the long-feared arrival of global flu epidemic, in which crisis the registry could be used to track who received a special vaccine or antidote to the deadly germ. Well, anything you can do to better the pinpoint who's vaccinated and who's not, that's very virtually vital, said Michael Ostrom, director of the Center of Disease Control and Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And I wish more cities were doing this kind of thing. I get a laugh with the way they wrote this. But Boston is believed to be the first city to embrace the particular approach to tracking vaccinations against seasonal flu, estimated to kill 36,000 people each year in the United States, principally the elderly. Okay. But you know, there's only been 1,000 deaths so far related to this flu. All right. And when the large catastrophic event, people end up in a variety of healthcare facilities, said Dr. Anita Berry, Boston's director of Communicable Diseases Control, and of course, their family family members and loved ones are trying to find out where they are and how they're doing. And to see how well the system would work, emergency crews tested it at the Boston Marathon and the 4th of July extravaganza on the Esplanade. And the trial proved successful.
That's good to know. It's a bizarre article.
And every autumn in medicine, it sounds like they were inviting you to Boston in the fall.
To get tracked?
Yeah. Every autumn in medical offices across the country, flu vaccines flood in. And the perishable medical product must be delivered to millions in a matter of months. The guy loves alliteration. Millions in a matter of months. And this guy's, I don't know.
The flowery writer of the news.
I don't think so. I think he's kind of got a thing for, I don't know what he's got. But anyway, check this guy out if you want a weird ride.
So you can get a bracelet and a flu shot at the same time, huh?
Stephen Smith, Globe staff. November 21st, 2008. This is on the, I just noticed the date.
Really?
Yeah. November 21st, 2008.
So they'd already done that a whole year ago.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're continuing to do that.
I don't know.
That's an interesting thought.
Keep track of the cash of vaccine, which patients are getting in. There was 300 of them that got trapped, okay, to see what would happen to them. All right. And some medical officers, the information is entered into electronic medical records. A Boston Health Department nurse fills out paper forms. But there's never been any way to systematically monitor whether, for example, Dorchester has lower vaccination rates than North End. And when you're working on one clinic, you don't have a good sense of that, said Dr. Albert DeMaria, a top disease doctor of Massachusetts Department of Defense. They all got titles like the lot, you know. But if you're tracking multiple clinics in real time, yeah, okay. Well, anyway, a lot of hooey, but
yeah.
But read it anyway. It's just
a lot of hooey.
Kind of like a, I don't know, feel like a mental anguish. You can read that article.
And they had no follow up on that, so you wonder if it was dropped.
Alliteration. Yeah, I pulled that up off of, I don't know why that was up there without comment, but it's a current news blog. But it was on there.
This is from the McClatchy Washington Bureau, posted on Sunday, October 25th. And updated on the 26th. Cost of Afghanistan project soars, benefits exaggerated. Flipping a switch on one of Afghanistan's long-awaited electrical power plants in August, U.S. Ambassador Carl Eikenberry urged Afghans to think of U.S. taxpayer support when they turn their lights on at night. Only about 6% of Afghans are estimated to have electricity, and his appearance with President Hamid Karzai, east of Kabul, Eikenberry hailed the project as part of the country's emergence out of the darkness of oppression and isolation. To some U.S. experts, however, the project is the latest example of exaggerated political expectations and a waste of taxpayer dollars in an effort to rebuild Afghanistan. Plagued by delays and rising costs, the project reveals how the U.S. government continues to ignore the hard lessons of Iraq. The Afghan government is expected to need up to $70 million in aid a year to truck in diesel fuel for the power plant that they built and at least $60 million to maintain and repair it. U.S. officials, who once envisioned the project as a major supply of electricity in the region, now describe it as an expensive backup system. Meanwhile, the plant's construction costs, because it's not completed, have ballooned from about $240 million to $310 million, according to U.S. officials. Eikenberry's visit marked the completion of only the project's first phase, which was supposed to have been completed last December. Critics say that the U.S. Agency for International Development, the government organization that's overseeing the project, should have foreseen many of the power plant's setbacks, but instead made matters worse by setting an unrealistic deadline from the outset, requiring the first phase to be done in 5 months. Among Afghans, the power plant became known as Karzai's winter coat, designed to keep him comfortably in power through the winter of 2009, and also a project that the Bush administration could hold up as a success before George W. Bush left office, an achievement needed to counter reports of cost overruns and delays. Kohastani Hamadayoun, technical deputy at Afghan's Ministry of Energy and Water, said a diesel-fueled power plant had appeared to be the only alternative at the time because hydropower would have taken 7 years to develop. It was only later that another option emerged, importing electricity from neighboring Turkestan, which now provides cheaper power to Afghanistan than the plant does. It is an urgent need for Kabul City, and the cost of power is funded through international money, Hamadayoun said. Like Halliburton, which by some estimates took in more than $10 billion in Iraq reconstruction contracts, Lewis Berger of Black and Vitech received a so-called cost-plus, let me turn the page here, contract, which reimbursed costs and pays a percentage of those expenses as fees. Cost-plus contracts can encourage waste and overbilling, experts have said. Auditors and investigators who scrutinized Halliburton contracts over several years in Iraq, for instance, found millions of dollars in double billing and inflated costs. Republican Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, who's called for ending cost-plus contracts and has been critical of U.S. oversights of them, describes cost-plus contracts as an open invitation to the contractors to rip off the government. According to the U.S. government estimates, fraud and corruption resulted in losses of up to 6% in government contracts. We're talking about numbers as high as $50 billion in contracts. Like we're in Afghanistan, we're talking about significant amounts of money, says Ray DiNunzio, the Assistant Inspector General for Investigations for the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. We're seeing fraud not only with the U.S. contractor companies, but within government agencies that are responsible for overseeing contracts, and even on a larger scale among Afghan nationals who are awarded some of the contracts. According to the USAID, Lewis Berger, Black, and VTech have completed 6 projects 3 years into the joint contract at a total of almost $54 million, or less than 5% of the total contract value. Projects in the contract overseen by the company, according to USAID, include an $11.9 million study of the viability of using natural gas field to fuel a 100-megawatt plant, a $50 million restoration of the Karjaki Dam. However, the company said that the major security problems had understandably and severely hampered several of their projects. Since Lewis Berger began its work in the region, 200 workers have been killed, 300 wounded, and a vast majority of them security subcontractors. The Taliban insurgents have made significant efforts to put an end to company projects, but they continue to make progress throughout Afghanistan. Separately, the Special Inspector General's Office, an independent government watchdog that was set up a year ago to monitor contracts in Afghanistan for waste and fraud, is ramping up its ability to pursue criminal allegations. DiNunzio, a 24-year FBI agent and certified public accountant, is overseeing the hiring of 12 additional criminal investigators by the end of the year. The 10 agents currently assigned to the criminal investigation have about 40 investigations ongoing. So we'll see what happens there. It's very hard to take care of the waste, the fraud, and the corruption. It seems to be all around on all sides.
They think it's like
play money, monopoly
that's
money.
That's what it is. So I said the price of doing business.
Oh, yeah?
The cost of doing business.
They throw it around like it's monopoly money.
Homeland Security could lock websites during swine flu pandemic. This troubled me. You can get this on,
I think we read a similar one before.
Yeah, but it's on
the article.
I wanted to read it. PrisonPlanet.com. Paul Watson. The government is being encouraged to prepare a block website and internet traffic in the event of a worsening swine flu pandemic that results in network congestion. A move that represents a potential end run around the agenda to regulate the World Wide Web. And a report by the General Accountability Office warns that a severe pandemic or a worsening of the H1N1 outbreak could result in 40% absentee rates at work and school, meaning the internet could be overloaded with people working from home, as well as bored children sucking up bandwidth via ongoing gaming. And the Securities Exchanges already have backed up systems to cope
with such a scenario, but the same cannot be said for general commerce, warns the report, adding the federal government, specifically Homeland Security, should be given the power to block certain websites and regulate internet traffic. What the hell websites are going to block? No.
Why does that bother you when you have the flu in your home?
Huh?
Isn't that around the flu epidemic that they were going to do that?
No, but what I'm saying is, no, what I'm saying is, the report states to reduce the resistance, I lost it. But whatever, they were talking about restricting, it was very broad-based here, it's talking about restricting the internet. You know,
just generally
and
restricting.
Websites,
mm-hmm.
Certain websites, what
mm-hmm.
if certain websites can't go on? What's that all about? I think they're going to ban the LA School Show, they're going to ban the, Huffington Post or something, like, you know what I mean?
Whatever doesn't agree with the government speak?
I guess so.
They have to have the approved spoken word, I guess.
Well, I don't know. But anyway, the GAO reports also highlights the lack of knowledge about what the public, other federal agencies, as well as the Internet service providers, would cooperate with any directive to regulate the Internet during a pandemic. And the Department of Homeland Security, General Levine, hinted that the feds would be eager to regulate the web and block websites in the event of a pandemic, stating
epidemic?
No. Expectation of unlimited internet access during a pandemic is not realistic. All right. So
what does internet access have to do with a pandemic?
Nothing.
That's
and,
what
and,
I'm asking.
Why would you want to jam certain websites?
Yeah, that's what would that have to do with a pandemic?
Yeah, I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Unless you got a bunch of websites like Prison Planet. Okay, you're coming up with news all the time about this stuff. Would they want their website banned? Probably. Yeah. Would they want our show banned because we're talking about it? Would they want,
What I don't understand is how you can consider that part of a national emergency. So you have a flu epidemic.
I have no idea.
Why does blocking? It doesn't seem to me to be logical to block websites because of a flu epidemic.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone that's caught the flu from a website.
And I mean, they want to do that, but yet they allow Chinese and websites and to crash into American websites all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They allow, cybersecurity that is lax at the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everything they want. Why don't they do that first? But no, they got to stop us. Can't let anybody talk. Hey.
Well, they haven't done it yet.
Hi, I can't reach you by phone because there's a pandemic. And you can't reach my email because there's a jam on your line because, wrote a nasty letter to the White House.
It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no logical rationale.
No, they're just
that.
Trying to mind mess your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Mind is a classic word for that. But that's what we're looking at. So everything you hear and see about Obama is a mind mess.
No, it seems to be.
It's a total mind.
And again, I can say I'm so happy I didn't vote for him.
Mindset.
I feel great that I didn't.
The mindset.
And how do you feel, Leo?
How do I feel?
You voted for him.
Did I vote for him?
Mm-hmm.
I was lost that day.
I guess so. I thought you.
I was wandering around that voting booth. I don't know. It was that. And I was so.
At least you told me you did.
Yeah. No, I didn't. Voted for McCain.
Yeah, I doubt it.
McCain. I wrote it in Lieberman.
No, I don't think so.
Do you have that article on Lieberman?
I do. This is what I'm going to read right now.
My hero, Lieberman.
I don't think so.
I love Lieberworm. I love that guy.
Yeah, right.
I do.
This is from Politico. Lieberman, I'll block the vote on the Reid plan. Senator Joe Lieberman said Tuesday that he'd back a GOP filibuster of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's health care reform bill. Lieberman, who caucuses with Democrats and is positioning himself as a fiscal hawk on the issue, said he opposes any health care bill that includes a government-run insurance program, even if it includes a provision allowing states to opt out of the program. We're trying to do too much at once, Lieberman said. To put this government-created insurance company on top of everything else is just asking for trouble for the taxpayers, for the premium payers, and for the national debt. I don't think we need it now. Of course, he has great health care in the Senate, so what he means is, I don't need it now. Asked about Lieberman's threat to filibuster a final vote on the Reid plan, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said, I haven't seen the report from Senator Lieberman of why he's saying what he's saying. I think Democrats and Republicans alike will be held, and I'm going to sneeze, folks. I think Democrats and Republicans alike will be held accountable by their constituents who want to see health care reform enacted this year. Lieberman said he'd vote against a public auction plan even with an opt-out because it still creates a whole new government entitlement program for which taxpayers will be on the line. Yeah, we're also on the line for the war you wanted, Joe, and we don't support it. I'd rather have health care. His comments confirm that Reid is short of the 60 votes needed to advance the bill out of the Senate. Even after Reid included the opt-out provisions, several of the moderate Democrats expressed skepticism, blah, blah, blah. Lieberman did say he's strongly inclined to vote to proceed to the debate, but that he'll ultimately vote to block a floor vote on the bill if it isn't changed first. Let's see. Oh, this is what he says at the end of the article. I feel this way about national government-created health insurance company, whether it's a trigger or not, he said. My answer is where we have the opportunity to do some great reforms here. These exchanges that we're talking about, I think they're going to drive competition and probably bring the cost of health insurance down or at least contain the cost increases for a lot of people. Let's give that 2 or 3 years to see how it works, to see how it works before we talk about creating another entitlement that'll end up increasing the national debt. He really wants to vote for health care reform, he says. Yeah, right. Like, I wonder if he's whining while he's talking or sniffling the way he does.
Oh, you got him down here. You got a very good... You know what surprised me? That guy on Saturday Night Live.
I can't stand him.
Why that guy doesn't do Lieberman?
I have no idea.
Lieberman would be perfect to do. I don't know why nobody impersonates Lieberman.
Yeah, because he's such a whiner.
I know.
Well, he doesn't think anybody needs health care because he has good health care himself. Paid for by the taxpayer, by the way.
Okay.
If we didn't have to pay for the Congress's health care, maybe our national debt would go down.
I think so. You got a shorty there you could read while I get the money out of them?
Let's see.
Okay. Got John Vernon coming up in just a minute.
Oh, here's one I can just mention. This is from the Washington Post. This is kind of interesting. U.S. official resigns over Afghan war. Excuse me. The Foreign Service officer and former Marine captain says he no longer knows why his nation is fighting. When Matthew Ho joined the Foreign Service early this year, he was exactly the kind of smart, civil military hybrid the administration was looking for to help expand its development efforts in Afghanistan. A former Marine Corps captain with combat experience in Iraq, Ho had also served in uniform at the Pentagon and as a civilian in Iraq and at the State Department. By July, he was a senior U.S. civilian in Zabul province, a Taliban hotbed. But last month, in a move which that has sent ripples all the way to the White House, Ho, 36, became the first U.S. official known to resign in protest over the Afghan war, which he had come to believe simply fueled the insurgency. I have lost understanding of and confidence in the strategic purposes of the United States' presence in Afghanistan, he said. He wrote on September 10th in a four-page letter to the department's head of personnel, I have doubts and reservations about our current strategy and planned future strategy, but my resignation is based not upon how we are pursuing the war, but why and to what end. The reaction to Ho's letter was immediate. Senior U.S. officials concerned that they would lose an outstanding officer and perhaps gain a prominent critic appealed to him to stay. Do you have John on the phone? Well, I'll wind up quickly. They did offer him a really perk job, and he refused to take it. He protests the purpose of the war, and I sure admire people like that because he had a lot of money dangled in front of him, I'm sure.
Yeah, I respect all that. All right, we got John Brennan on.
Hey, John, how are you?
And I got some new bumper music tonight here for me. It's my new intro song.
Oh, good.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. This will be my new intro song for a few weeks, perhaps. But I won't back down. Gonna stand.
tonight we're going to stand our ground on the fact that the people that are being given vaccines may be completely, damaged by what they're taking. Have you talked about that earlier on the show, I think?
Yeah, I read a little article by that Ron Paul has challenged Obama because he hasn't given his daughters the H1N1 virus shot.
I wonder why. They maybe know something we don't know.
And there's also...
Any of the little people take the shots, perhaps, huh?
And there's also...
I think you'll hear, and it's entitled, "The Vaccine May Be More Dangerous Than the Swine Flu." And it's by Dr. Russell Blaylock, who's one of the leading neurosurgeons, brain surgeons, in the United States. And he's a board-certified neurosurgeon. And I always say, never argue with a brain surgeon. He says that despite the predictions of massive numbers of deaths and the arrival of doomsday, the virus has remained a relatively mild disease, something we know happens each year with flu epidemics. Worldwide, there are only 377 deaths out of 70,893 cases of swine flu. That was as of 7709. In the United States, 27,717 cases have resulted in 127 deaths. Each death is a tragedy. But such a low death rate should not be the basis of a draconian government policy. Recall that the Center for Disease Control, with the collusion of the media, constantly tell us that 36,000 people will die from the flu each year, a figure that has been shown to be a lie. In this case, we are talking about 300-plus deaths for the entire world. This virus continues to be an enigma for virologists. In the April 30th, 2009 issue of Nature, a virologist was quoted as saying, "Where the hell got all these genes from, we don't know. Extensive analysis of the virus found that it contained the original 1918 H1N1 flu virus, the avian flu virus, that's the bird flu, and two new H3N2 virus genes from Eurasia. Debate continues over the possibility that the swine flu is genetically engineered as a virus. Naturally, vaccine manufacturers have been in a competitive battle to produce the first vaccine. The main contenders have been Baxter Pharmaceutical and Novartis Pharmaceutical, the latter of which was recently acquired by the scandal-ridden Acheron Vaccine Company. Both of these companies have had agreements with the World Health Organization to produce a pandemic vaccine. The Baxter Company has been associated with two deadly scandals. The first event occurred in 2006 when hemophiliac components were contaminated with HIV, that's the AIDS virus, and injected in tens of thousands of people, including thousands of children. The second event occurred recently when it was discovered that the Baxter company had released a seasonal flu containing the bird flu virus to 18 countries, which would have produced a real-world pandemic. Now, fortunately, the astute lab workers in the Czechoslovakian Republic discovered the deadly combination and then blew the whistle before a worldwide disaster was unleashed on us. Despite these two deadly events, the World Health Organization maintains an agreement with Baxter Pharmaceuticals to produce the world's pandemic vaccine. Novartis, the second contender, also has an agreement with the World Health Organization for a pandemic vaccine. Now, Novartis appears to have won the contract, since the vaccine contains ingredients called immune adjuvants. Sorry, I skipped a line here. Actually, since the vaccine is near completion, GlaxoSmithKline has the contract for Canada. What is terrifying is that these pandemic vaccines contain ingredients called immune adjuvants that a number of studies have shown can cause devastating autoimmune disorders, including rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and lupus. The animal studies using the adjuvants have found them to be deadly. A study using 14 guinea pigs found that when they were injected with the special adjuvant, only one animal survived. A repeat of the study found the same deadly outcome. So what is the deadly ingredient? Well, it's called squalene. It's a type of oil. The Acheron company, maker of the deadly anthrax vaccine, makes an adjuvant called MF59, which contains, guess what, squalene. A number of studies have shown that squalene can trigger all of the above-mentioned autoimmune diseases when injected. I reviewed a number of studies on the adjuvant and found something quite interesting about the adjuvant. Several studies done on human subjects, test subjects, found MF59 to be a very safe immune adjuvant. But when I checked to see who did the studies, I found, to no surprise, that they were done by the Novartis Pharmaceutical Company and Chiron, a pharmaceutical company, which have merged. They were all published in prestigious medical journals. Also, to no surprise, a great number of studies done by independent laboratories and research institutions all found a strong link between MF59 and autoimmune diseases. Squalene in vaccines has been strongly linked to the Gulf War syndrome. On August 1991, Anthony Recipe, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, admitted that soldiers vaccinated with the anthrax vaccine from 1990 to 1991 had an increased risk of 200% in developing the deadly disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, that's ALS. It's also called Lou Gehrig's disease. The soldiers also suffered from a number of debilitating and life-shortening diseases, such as polyarthritis, nodosis, multiple sclerosis, lupus, transverse myelitis, which is a neurological disorder caused by inflammation of the spinal cord, optic neuritis with blindness, and it's a type of kidney disease. I have to be a doctor to say that one, I'm afraid. Because squalene, the main ingredient in the MF59, can induce hyperimmune types of prolonged responses, and a real danger exists for prolonged activation of the brain's immune cells, the microalgia. This type of prolonged activation has been strongly associated with such diseases as multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease, and Parkinson's disease, ALS, and possibly vaccine-related encephalitis. It's been shown that activation of the systemic immune system, as occurs with the vaccination, rapidly activates the brain's microglia at the same time, and this brain inflammation can persist for long periods. What most people do not know, even the doctors who recommend the vaccines, is that most studies by pharmaceutical companies observe the patients for only 1 to 2 weeks following vaccination. These types of reactions may take months or even years to manifest. It is obvious that the vaccine manufacturers stand to make billions of dollars in profit from this World Health Organization and government-promoted pandemic. One must keep in mind that once the vaccine is injected, there is little you can do to protect yourself, at least by conventional medicine. It will mean a lifetime of crippling illness and early death. There are much safer ways to protect yourself from this flu virus, such as higher doses of vitamin D3, selective immune enhancement, using supplements and a good diet. And there's another journalist, investigative journalist, his name is Gary Matsumoto, and he did a brilliant expose of the squalene in vaccines. You can also check this, well, not this article, but there's on YouTube. You can just type in, if you've got a pen, please try and write this down. YouTube, Dr. Russell Laylock, B-L-A-Y-L-O-C-K, on swine flu. Dr. Russell Blaylock on swine flu, YouTube, and you will hear this great neurosurgeon speak on it. Even if there's doctors out there, I would like them to go and check this out. Sorry about the pronunciation there, because I'm in a rather hurry reading it.
No, you did just fine. That's quite scary, isn't it, John?
It really is. You know, they just take advantage of the population's innocence, I suppose. I was also reading something just before I came on air about, how people are really mind controlled to take the flu viruses, and they actually use television and stuff built into the TV series. So it all works together at the highest levels of these corporations. I'm just going to play a little example here of how they do it. This is only, like, I think, a 4-minute clip from the Corbett Report, and he's doing, I think it's a TV show.
From the Corbett Report.
30 of the Rock or something.
This is from the Corbett Report.
So, you've just finished listening to a particularly disturbing episode of the Corbett Report podcast about...
Oh, I'm sorry, I got something wrong here. I queued up two things together here, and we're going to have to get rid of one of them.
Okay.
Two things can't work together, so we're going to have to get rid of the music and bring back up the Corbett Report. I think we can go ahead and try it again.
Viruses being mixed in with flu vaccines, and the swine flu perhaps having originated in a vaccine lab. So in order to escape the cares of the world, you decide to turn on the television set. And as the comforting blue glow starts to envelop your living room, and as the scientifically engineered flicker rate of the television begins to slow your brainwaves down into a sub-sleep state, you decide to turn on that wonderful NBC comedy series, 30 Rock, starring Alec Baldwin and Tina Fey.
There you are.
See, I'm giving out flu shots.
Got yourself lucky. You're getting
rationing healthcare? That's not okay.
Margaret and I, you're one of us now. One of the elite.
I'm still way more like those people than you. And I don't want anything they don't get.
Well, then you don't want to get sick.
It's not about that. It's about fairness. I don't want the shot.
Are you ready for your shot?
If my crew can't get a shot, I'm not getting a shot.
There you go, Liz.
God bless you, crewman. We gotta fight the power.
Yeah.
Fight the power that be.
Discovered that over
Okay, I just have to turn over the tape. So, bear with me. A second. Okay, we'll start in a second.
Search online for Act on CO2.
Unbelievable. It's absolutely unbelievable, the kind of propaganda they're pushing. You know, and the little innocent kid there in the ad, I just was shocked. And the other children, you know, her age are watching this. They don't want us to warm our houses anymore. They want us to stop driving cars. I mean, we go back to being like the Chinese. I've heard people like Alex Jones say, yeah, China is the new, the model. They want us to go back in time.
They want us to reduce meat consumption because...
Everything.
Nothing, yeah. I mean, it's absolutely insane. Everything they're talking about is insane, and you have to respect...
So China is the model?
Humanity.
A model for how they want us to live?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly, you know, low wages, just...
Yeah, $2 a day.
And be happy.
Third world country standard. You know, that's really sad. Very, very sad. Well, it's certainly moving in that direction. I mean, they want to sign that Copenhagen Treaty.
That's right. Yeah, I did send you, Leo, the clip that we messed up with last week. It should be sent to you there without the music. If you go on to play that right now, it's an excellent piece.
Yeah, he's going to go in and find that, John. Next week, we're going to have John McManus on from the John Birch Society. He's going to talk about that Copenhagen Treaty.
Oh, good.
So,
time to read one more. I'm going to go here.
Go right ahead if it's not too long while Leo's finding that clip.
Yes, he's finding the clip. Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, let's see if we can bring that one up. That'll save me reading this next article.
Go ahead and read.
The article is entitled Criminalizing Everybody, and this is from the Washington Times. It's by Brian Walsh. You don't need to know. You can't know. That's what Kathy Norris, a 60-year-old grandmother of 8, was told when she tried to ask court officials why, the day before, federal agents had subjected her house to a furious search. The agents who spent half a day ransacking Mrs. Norris's longtime home in Spring, Texas, answered no questions while they emptied file cabinets, pulled books off the shelves, rifled through drawers and closets, and threw the contents on the floor. The six agents wearing SWAT gear and carrying weapons were with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
What?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Kathy and George Norris lived under the specter of a covert government investigation for almost 6 months before the government unsealed a secret indictment and revealed why the Fish and Wildlife Service had entered their family home, as if it were a training base for suspected terrorists. Orchids. Yes, that's right, orchids. By March 2004, federal prosecutors were well on their way to turning 66-year-old retiree George Norris into an inmate in a federal penitentiary based on his home-based business of cultivating, importing, and selling orchids. Mrs. Norris testified before the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime this summer. The hearing's topic, the rapid and dangerous expansion of federal criminal law, an expansion that is often unprincipled and highly partisan. These two leaders have begun giving voice to the increasing number of experts who worry about over-criminalization. Astronomical numbers of federal criminal laws lack specifics, can apply to almost anyone, and fail to protect innocence by requiring substantial proof that an accused person acted with actual criminal intent. Mr. Norris ended up spending almost 2 years in prison because he didn't have the proper paperwork for some of the many orchids he imported. The orchids were all legal, but Mr. Norris and the overseas shippers who had packaged the flowers had failed to properly navigate the many, often irrational, paperwork requirements the U.S. imposed when it implemented an arcane international treaty with new restrictions on trade in flowers and other flora. The judge who sentenced Mr. Norris had some advice for him and his wife. Life sometimes presents us with lemons. Their job was, yes, to turn lemons into lemonade. The judge apparently failed to appreciate how difficult it is to run a successful lemonade stand when you're an elderly diabetic with coronary complications, arthritis, and Parkinson's disease, serving time in a federal penitentiary. If only Mr. Norris had been a Libyan terrorist, maybe some European official at least would have weighed in on his behalf to secure a health-based mercy release. Kristen Evertson, another victim of over-criminalization, told Congress, "What I have experienced in the last 3 years is something that should scare you and all Americans." He's right, Everson, a small-time entrepreneur and inventor, faced two separate federal prosecutions stemming from his work trying to develop clean energy fuel cells. The feds prosecuted Mr. Everson, the first time for failing to put a federally mandated sticker on an otherwise lawful UPS package in which he shipped some of his supplies. The jury acquitted him, so the feds brought up new charges. This time they claimed he technically had abandoned his fuel cell materials, something he had no intention of doing, while defending himself against the first charges. Mr. Evertson, too, spent almost 2 years in federal prison. The George Washington University law professor Stephen Salzberg testified at the House hearing, "Cases like these illustrate, about as well as you can illustrate, the overreach of federal criminal law." The Cato Institute's Timothy Lynch, an expert on overcriminalization, called for a clean line between lawful conduct and unlawful conduct. A person should not be deemed a criminal unless that person crossed over the line knowing what he or she was doing. Seems like common sense, but apparently it isn't to some federal officials. Former U.S. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh's testimony captured the essence of the problems that worry so many criminal law experts. "Those of us concerned about this subject," he testified, "share a common goal to have criminal statutes that punish actual criminal acts and that do not seek to criminalize conduct that is better dealt with by the seeking of regulatory and civil remedies." "Only when the conduct is sufficiently wrongful and severe," Mr. Thornburgh said, "does it warrant the stigma, public condemnation, and potential deprivation of liberty to go along with the criminal sanction." The Norris' nightmare began with the search in October 2003. It didn't end until Mr. Norris was released from federal supervision in December 2008. His wife testified, however, that even after he came home, the man she had married was still gone. He was by then 71 years old, unsurprisingly serving 2 years as a federal convict, in addition to the years it took to defend unsuccessfully against the charges had taken a severe toll on him mentally, emotionally, and physically. These are repressive consequences for an elderly man who made mistakes in a small business. The feds should be ashamed. And Mr. Evertson is right that everyone else should be scared. Far too many federal laws are far too broad. Mr. Scott and Mr. Gohmert have set the stage for more hearings on why this places far too many Americans at risk for unjust punishment. Members of both parties in Congress should follow their lead. Brian W. Walsh is a senior legal research fellow in the Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation.
All right.
And as I said, that was from the Washington Times.
That was quite an article, John. It's shocking.
It is, but we've been trying to tell people on this show that since the events of 9/11, they have used that event, which is very questionable in itself, to bring in the Patriot Act, and within the Patriot Act, things like what happened here can be justified.
Mm-hmm. And you get a bunch of bureaucrats who just don't care and don't understand what they're doing, and they just go out and do it.
There's no other way, a simple point of the word. It's Nazism. Fascism, maybe, but it's between those two. Take your pick,
yeah.
In my opinion.
I don't think you're far from wrong.
Yeah, if you think that's all bad, it gets worse. I've got the tape over here, and we're going to put that on by Lord Monckton. Lord Monckton.
Yep.
Okay.
Excellent. That's a great piece.
Climate change expert. And October 14th, 2003, it's on the Internet, and on the YouTube, rather. Yeah, we're going to play that now. We hope.
Why don't you give a station ID quickly before you do?
All right. This is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon, Lakeville, and Millerton. You're listening to the LA Steel Show. And right now we have Lord Monckton.
Q103 is WQQQ.
Sorry, wrong Lord Monckton. There you go.
You got it? It should be coming in just a minute.
And what are we doing instead? At Copenhagen, this December, weeks away, a treaty will be signed. Your president will sign it. Most of the third world countries will sign it because they think they're going to get money out of it. Most of the left-wing regimes around the world, like the European Union, will rubber stamp it. Virtually nobody won't sign it. I have read that treaty. And what it says is this, that a world government is going to be created. The word government actually appears as the first of three purposes of the new entity. The second purpose is the transfer of wealth from the countries of the West to third world countries in satisfaction of what is called, coyly, a climate debt. Because we've been burning CO2 and they haven't, and we've been screwing up the climate. We haven't been screwing up the climate, but that's the lie. And the third purpose of this new entity, this government, is enforcement. How many of you think that the word election or democracy or vote or ballot occurs anywhere in the 200 pages of that treaty? Quite right, it doesn't appear once. So at last, the communists who piled out of the Berlin Wall and into the environmental movement and took over Greenpeace so that my friends who founded it left within a year because they'd captured it. Now the apotheosis is at hand. They are about to impose a communist world government on the world. You have a president who has very strong sympathies with that point of view. He's going to sign. He'll sign anything. He's a Nobel Peace Laureate. Of course he'll sign it. And the trouble is this. If that treaty is signed, your constitution says that it takes precedence over your constitution. And you can't resile from that treaty unless you get the agreement of all the other states' parties. And because you'll be the biggest paying country, they're not going to let you out. So, thank you, America. You were the beacon of freedom to the world. It is a privilege merely to stand on this soil of freedom while it is still free. But in the next few weeks, unless you stop it, your president will sign your freedom, your democracy, and your prosperity away forever. And neither you nor any subsequent government you may elect will have any power whatsoever to take it back again. That is how serious it is. I have read the treaty. I've seen this stuff about government, climate debt, and enforcement. They are going to do this to you, whether you like it or no. But I think it is here, here in your great nation, which I so love and I so admire. It is here that perhaps, at this 11th hour, at the 59th minute and the 59th second, you will rise up and you will stop your president from signing that dreadful treaty, that purposeless treaty, for there is no problem with the climate, and even if there were, economically speaking, there's nothing we can do about it. So I end by saying to you the words that Winston Churchill addressed to your president in the darkest hour before the dawn of freedom in the Second World War. He quoted from your great poet Longfellow, "Sail on, O ship of state, sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity, with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate." Thank you.
All right, that was Lord Monckton, and environmental expert. And Johnny, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. I'm glad you played that. I couldn't hear it, but I know what it's about, so I'm glad you were able to get it through this week. I'm sorry about last week on that one.
No, that's okay.
Well, he plans to sign it in December, I think, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's right. So it's very close. So more people know about it, at least about it. They're going to push it through. There's nothing we can do about it. It's a pay up, but we want people to know that as they pay, this is the greatest, I don't know what to call it, whatever, it's just a swindle, there's no other word, the greatest swindle ever pulled across the American people, between this and cap and trade.
And the bailouts.
There's just so many, it boggles the mind at this stage.
Well, they're bankrupting the country, and they're just reducing the American citizens to dirt.
Yeah,
that's the plan. They want us, the Chinese model is what they would like us to go back to. That we served our purpose for the last few hundred years, and now they're switching us off.
Well, it's not up to them to do that, Johnny. You know, it's up to us to switch them off. And we've got every right to do that. And I think that's what's happening. And I think when I read about this H1N1, and pregnant mothers, and four out of five pregnant mothers said they don't want to take the the vaccination. You know, Obama's not inoculating his kids. And they're in the highest age group for the vulnerability. So, I don't know, Johnny. Looks like we're in for a wild ride.
But anyway, all we can do is give the people the information and don't take our word for it. Do your own investigations and look at all sides. You know, if you think everything we said is complete bunkum, like I said, that you're basically telling me that Dr. Blaylock, a brain surgeon, I find it hard to argue with a brain surgeon myself, but I would trust him before I trust any pharmaceutical representative or a drug company, given the piece I just read, how these contaminants have damaged people, and there's no comeback on those people. So if you take it, it's a one-way ticket to hell.
Oh, whatever. We're on that ride right now, I think. Helter skelter.
Yeah, well, I'm not taking any vaccine over my dead body. Whatever happens, happens. I can blame myself if something happens, but I'm not going to be connected with any medicine of any sort anymore.
I mean, they put Manson behind bars for what, the rest of his life, and and they're doing this to us. Yeah, it's unbelievable. That's absolutely unbelievable.
And those who take the vaccine will probably contaminate the rest of us. That's the sad thing about it.
I mean, Manson couldn't have thought up a better way to kill somebody, really, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there've been lots of crazy people, and this.
Well, who's crazier than the H1N1 maker uppers, huh?
I don't disagree with you.
Pharmaceutical companies. Who's crazier than that?
Very sick.
Good God. Who's crazier than Lukowski?
Well, the history of the polio vaccine is very similar. It didn't really prevent polio.
It later caused cancer in everyone who took it. You know, all our friends, everybody who's got a cancer or died young is probably because of the reaction to their 1950s vaccination.
That's right. I think the guy who was in Salk and Rowland, both of them were saying that do not take it afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, years after they had studied what was in it, they were screaming holy murder, but the press wouldn't give them the light of day.
And basically what cleaned up polio was the cleaning up of the
public sewers.
They were dumping raw sewage into bays where people were sleeping and they swimming in ponds.
People had outhouses back in the 30s, you know.
And 40s.
And 40s.
Mm-hmm.
In 30s and 40s, people still went outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or if they were rich, they went indoors, but the stuff went outdoors. You know, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, they didn't have good plumbing. They didn't have...
Oh, God, no.
In Ireland, when I was in school in Ireland in the 1960s, we had outhouses. There was no plumbing.
Really? Wow. Well, we were advanced, and by the 60s we got indoor plumbing by the 60s, I think, by the 50s we had indoor plumbing, and I was born in a household with indoor plumbing.
Well, next week, as I said to you, John, we're having John McManus on from the John Birch Society, and he's going to talk about this Copenhagen Treaty, and probably, I would guess, he'll talk about what the Constitution says about the president being able to sign a treaty and what its validity will be. My understanding of the Constitution is that it has to be voted on. So.
Yeah. So that's what I heard as well. But we're going to be talking to John McManus next week. And he's going to fill us in on what the Patriots are up against, are up to, and their attitude about this stuff. So, thanks, John, for your report tonight. Appreciate it.
You did a great job, John. Thanks for bringing us on.
Well, we couldn't record it in a short time, so I hope people got some information out of it. Now, once again, that Dr. Russell Blaylock on YouTube, Russell Blaylock on the swine flu. Just put that phrase in, and you'll find some excellent material.
And don't forget Lord Monckton. Okay.
That was the other guy.
Yeah.
And thanks again, John.
Thanks so much, Johnny.
Okay, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. Good night, folks.
Good night and have a good week. That was John Brennan talking to us from Litchfield on the swine flu vaccine. He brought us a clip on the Copenhagen Treaty, which was very good.
Yeah.
And about embedding ideas into the media, how certain ideas are transmitted to us and give us certain beliefs. Leo has some songs that he's going to play, and he's coughing right now, but he'll get into it.
I didn't expect that to happen. I just kind of like went to the mic. Lila's.
It's my turn to cough now.
Yes. All right, I apologize for that. But anyway, we've got a little thing, a couple of music things to play you, and then we'll be back. And our special guest tonight is George Dixon, and he'll be talking about the Mayan calendar. He'll be talking about the H1N1 flu virus genocide, facts and figures. We'll be talking about ascension consciousness, unity consciousness, and we'll be there with Wizard George Dixon. That'll be coming up shortly, in about 20 minutes. So, here we go. And this is a little birthday song for a guy.
Everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. Join us tomorrow night when we will be discussing spirituality. And another reading by esoteric masters. And we will be, and then Friday night, I believe we will have George Dixon joining us. But anyway, I want to thank you for joining us tonight, and have a pleasant evening.
Thank you.